Welcome, everyone, to Truth Nation Podcast 35. I am Bill Bodner. The retired chief, Mark Garrett, is here as always. What's happening, Chief?
Bill, it's all happening. Lots to talk about today.
Yeah, it is. It is all happening. Chief, we are going to talk today about the Sean P. Diddy Combs case. Last month, in September, I don't know if it was the 16th or 17th, he's arrested in New York, hit with federal charges. It wasn't a surprise to him, right? He knew he was under investigation. There was a lot going on in the media. And even just this criminal case was not really the beginning of his issues. Dating back for about a year, there's been civil lawsuits filed against him. I think I counted 9 pending civil lawsuits, but surely more to come. And we'll maybe talk a little bit about that. To help us with the legal breakdown, we have Sean Carney, Deputy District Attorney for LA County. Now, listen, although this case is filed in New York, but the underlying crimes took place here in California, and they are the very types of crimes that Sean has basically made his career prosecuting here in LA County. So we'll do a little bit of a dive into this stuff. A couple things that I haven't heard talked about, which we're going to get into, are the asset forfeiture allegations. In other words, the government intends to take some property from Sean Combs. And, you know, the types of federal charges that he's hit with, what the government has to show to prove these charges, et cetera. So, Sean, thank you for joining us for this kind of legal analysis of what's ahead here for Mr. Combs. Good to have you here again.
Thank you very much, Bill. Good to see you and Mark again. As always, these are my personal opinions, not those of my office, but I'm happy to contribute to this discussion.
So he's charged with RICO, guys. Now, here's what I know about RICO. I had some experience with it, but it's limited. It was generally street gang cases, maybe a large-scale Mexican drug trafficking organization. It's a law that was put on the books back in the 1970s to really address organized crime, what I think the FBI would call LCN, La Cosa Nostra, traditional Italian organized crime, the mafia. That's where this law comes from. So it's been used against John Gotti, the Gambino crime family, the Medellin drug cartel, the Crips street gang, the Blood street gang. And now we see it here charging Sean P. Diddy Combs. Just that initial piece talking about RICO and the filing of a RICO charge against a single person. Sean, where does that sit?
Yeah.
Have you seen that, or is that normal?
It's unusual. Now, you know, I'm a state prosecutor, but I know lots of federal prosecutors, especially out here in LA. I've worked lots of state federal task forces that have resulted in prosecutions on both courts. You know, the other thing that is going on here is that the government didn't just charge RICO, they charged a RICO conspiracy.
Yeah.
Right. So by itself, a conspiracy requires an agreement of two people at least to commit, in this case, a violation of the RICO Act. Right. So already, now that doesn't mean the indictment is deficient in any way. It's not. They can allege unindicted co-conspirators. But it brings up an interesting point, which is you have a case here where they've charged RICO for sex trafficking and for crimes essentially related to that sex trafficking, including covering up his crimes, Sean Combs's crimes. But you've only got one named defendant so far. And the question comes up, which is, why is this a RICO case, right? As you said, RICO is an incredibly powerful tool that the government has used to bring down organized crime. And yeah, does this fit the technical definition of RICO? It probably does, right? RICO requires, for instance, that you have an enterprise. And in this particular charge, which I believe is 1562C of Title 18 of the US Code, it requires that Combs operated or engaged in a number of RICO acts through this enterprise. The enterprise is his businesses, Combs Enterprises and Bad Boy Enterprises. Right. So, yeah, it fits. Like, the government alleges that there were two or more predicate crimes, which is required for RICO to establish mm-hmm. that this is an organization that is engaging in criminal activities. They've alleged that, and they appear to have proof of that. A lot of it appears to be related to allegations by Cassie Ventura, who is Combs's former girlfriend, who famously there was the video of him beating her in the hotel. And there's other allegations the government has made related to Combs's relationship with Ventura. But why isn't this just a sex trafficking case? If you look at the Jeffrey Epstein case, which is probably the most famous analog to this case, right? You have a rich individual who has lots of means, who is engaging in sex trafficking with all kinds of women and minors and doing all kinds of illegal means to conduct it. Epstein was not charged with RICO violations. Epstein was charged with a conspiracy to sex traffic, and he was charged with federal sex trafficking. So why is it that the government in this case decided to use RICO? That's a good question.
Yeah. And I mean, hey, some of the most common crimes that make up, what would you call it, the predicate offenses or the underlying offenses in RICO cases, kidnapping, arson, bribery, drug trafficking, and all those are alleged here. All those crimes are alleged here.
You know,
go ahead, Sean.
One of the interesting parts of that is, you know, one of the reason RICO is such a powerful federal tool for prosecutors, and we have a version of it in California, actually, that is directed at criminal street gangs. So it doesn't have the same reach. Federal RICO has a very broad reach. And one of the things it allows the federal government to do is to prosecute persons that are participating in RICO acts and RICO enterprises who are conducting state crimes, right? And so it allows the government in part to sweep in a lot of these state crimes. So you look at what's alleged in the indictment against Combs, right? They allege crimes of arson, which I was an arson specialist for more than 10 years, still do lots of it. Interestingly, actually, the prosecutors in New York charged it wrong. One of the things that they alleged in their indictment, and this is a minor point, doesn't really mean it's a fatal flaw for the indictment, but in charging or in alleging the California arson statute as part of the predicate crimes, they included attempted arson. And not knowing that California, apparently they didn't know that California has a specific attempted arson statute, which is unusual for California. In California, when you charge an attempt, we usually charge a separate section, which is an attempt statute, and then we charge the target crime of the attempt. But in arson, it's an exception. Apparently they didn't know that. 455 of the penal code is attempted arson, and it's actually not proper for us to allege it the way I described and the way it's alleged in the New York indictment. But okay. But all these crimes are here. You have bribery, you have kidnapping, you have arson. And you look at that indictment and you say, wait, this is a federal indictment in New York and they're alleging crimes under the California Penal Code. That's weird. Mm-hmm. Why are all these crimes California cases instead of New York cases? Mm-hmm. Right. So that brings up another interesting question. One is, why is this a RICO case? And two is, why is this case in New York and not in California, if all these predicate crimes that they are alleging are occurring in California? Now, it doesn't mean that New York doesn't have jurisdiction to try this crime, but there's a requirement in federal prosecutions called venue, and it's where a case is appropriately brought. And one wonders why they have venue in New York and why it was brought there as opposed to California, where it seems like a lot of these acts are alleged to have taken place.
Especially, the incident in the hotel as well, that we talked about, the video that came out last spring in, was it March or I think March or April, May, I don't know, sometime last spring, the video of the abuse in the domestic violence or whatever you want to call it, assault in the hotel hallway. That was in Los Angeles, was it not?
That's right. It was in the Intercontinental Hotel in Century City. Absolutely correct. And the subsequent bribery that is alleged, where the government in this indictment alleges or in its paperwork it filed in connection with the bail, that Combs and his associates engaged in bribery, one of the acts is that they tried to pay off hotel security to bury that incident.
Right.
Absolutely. So Sean, let me go,
Mark.
And you've done a great job of at least addressing the questions around RICO. Now, to the best of my knowledge, non-lawyer knowledge and memory, RICO was brought into existence now going on, well, almost 40 years ago, I would say. Is that about right? Mid-80s
even,
or late
even
80s?
A little bit more, I think, actually. A little more like 50 or 60, I think.
Oh, 50 years ago. But it really was, I mean, the focus here really was organized crime, the mafia. I mean, is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. That's what RICO stands for.
So when we're looking at that, and look, when we look at this, we go through the indictment today and talk about all the, you know, the specifics of the charges alleged against Combs. As broad as the acts are, or the scope, I should say. The scope is still focused on one primary activity here, and this is the sexual exploitation. This is really the forced, you know, sex of some of these women through coercion, through bribery, through intimidation, through physical restraint, kidnapping. But from what I read here, that seems to be the focus. There's some ancillary things here. I say ancillary. They're all very, very serious. But when we look at the original application of RICO, just like you said, the racketeering, this is a broad scope of unrelated crimes that are all managed by a person or a group of people. And This seems to me, watching and reading documentaries, John Gotti, and you name, you know, the crime bosses, this seems like such a departure from what RICO has been used for over the last 5 or 6 decades. So
Mark, really you make a fantastic point. You absolutely make a great point.
I think that is a great point.
Let me add to that a little bit, if I may. So aside from whether or not there's a legal basis to charge RICO here, and there is, like they hit the elements, right? They can do it. The Department of Justice has to approve all RICO charges, right? I'm not talking about Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office. They have to ask permission from Maine Justice in Washington, D.C. There's a section that gives them permission to do it, right? And they do that for all U.S. attorneys throughout the country. And they have guidelines because, of course, the government has written guidelines for everything. So they have guidelines as to what kinds of RICO cases should be sought and approved and what kinds should not. And one of the considerations is not every RICO case that can be brought by the government should be brought by the government, right? That's in their guidelines. There's good reasons. If you abuse a powerful tool, you will create backlash against that tool. And the government doesn't want to lose the incredibly effective tool of RICO to defeat really difficult organizations like drug cartels and the mafia, right? So why are they bringing it in this case? Well, the considerations in DOJ guidelines are, could this case have been charged by the states? Weinstein was. He was charged both in Los Angeles and in New York with sexual assault, right? Tried independently, convicted in both cases. There's some issues with the New York one now, and they're bringing a second indictment there. But that's an example, right? Could this have been charged in the state? And if so, the government guidelines from the U.S. Department of Justice are, we should not step in when the states can handle these charges, because we are not the primary law enforcement tool that should be brought to bear. We should be brought to bear when you need a federal government to step in where states can't. That's one thing. And the second thing is, could this case have been brought just with substantive federal charges? They did that in Epstein. They charged conspiracy to sex traffic and sex traffic, which is transporting individuals across state lines for the purpose of engaging in commercial sex acts, right? That's charged as a substantive charge in this case, in the Combs case. But why also the RICO conspiracy, right? And so you're right, Mark, I think there's an interesting thing here, which is, why did they add that? Now, one theory I have, and I don't know if this is true, I haven't talked to any of the prosecutors there, is they can't charge all these acts that they allege that occurred in California. Like you say, all the baggage that they've thrown in under the RICO net, right? They can't charge that stuff unless they charge RICO. Right. Hmm. Otherwise, where would that be charged? I mean, maybe in L.A., maybe in my office, maybe in the U.S. Attorney's Office in California, which seems to have more of a connection in terms of the appropriate venue or place to bring the prosecution. But why did they bring RICO? Well, it allows them to bring all that stuff in. That's why RICO is such a powerful tool. Should they have in this case? I mean, it'd be interesting to be able to know the back and forth between Maine Justice and Southern District of New York. Southern District of New York is famous for grabbing onto high-profile cases because they're the Southern District of New York, and that's what they do. But is this a New York case or an LA case? Is this a RICO case or just a single count of trafficking and conspiracy to traffic? Those are great questions.
This is it. You know, you raised a great point here earlier about just because the federal government can charge RICO doesn't mean they should charge RICO. And we want to preserve the tool here and don't want to dull that edge, so to speak, on that very powerful tool. But you raise the point here, another point about, well, they can't, unless they charge RICO, they can't bring these specific state charges into the filing, into the indictment. The question is, well, so what? In other words, you made the point. You're the federal government. Stick to the things that you have jurisdiction to deal with. So this interstate travel, things like this, the specific federal violations, and then allow the local jurisdiction, whether it's the county of Los Angeles, state of California, whoever it may be, to bring the appropriate charge on the state level. This is a very interesting point you raise. In other words, is the federal government really overstepping its primary jurisdiction just because they want to keep the machine going, because they want to feed themselves with publicity and power and ask for more resources? You know, that's my question about this. Go ahead.
Also, Bill. Sean, is it a statute issue on these state charges?
No.
Could California still charge the predicate offenses just as state charges?
Well, not anymore. We could have.
Not anymore.
You know, because if I remember correctly, according to Cassie Ventura's lawsuit, which really fleshes out the details, for instance, behind the arson. So the allegation behind the arson, according to her civil lawsuit, not a criminal case, but her civil case, is that Diddy found out she was having an affair with another rapper here in Los Angeles. I think his name is Cootie. Forgetting the full name of that particular
Kid
artist. Kid Cootie, thank you.
And that's his birth name, by the way, Kid. Sorry.
Yeah. And so Combs got pissed off when he found out about this affair. Interestingly, it's reported that Combs found out during one of his infamous freak-offs, which are these sex parties that are alleged extensively throughout the indictment. During one of those freak-offs, he got a hold of Cassie Ventura's phone, went through the phone, found out she was having an affair with Kid Cootie, got pissed off, came out here to L.A. or was here in L.A. for whatever reason, cut open the rag top on Cootie's convertible and dropped in a Molotov cocktail, set the car on fire, right? This is an intimidation and terror tactic. And could I have prosecuted that case? Absolutely. In fact, I wouldn't have prosecuted it just as arson. I would have prosecuted it as a destructive device case, which is the same statute we use for bombs, because Molotov cocktails are classified as destructive devices, both state and federally. So either government could have brought that individual case. But at least as far as the state court goes, we're outside the statute of limitations now, because this occurred in 2011 or 2012. And the statute of limitations for those cases is generally 3 years. So I'm well outside the statute now. California could not charge that case.
So by making it a RICO case, the feds can still charge that. So that might be a key reason why it was done this way.
Yeah.
I think that the connection or the illustration using the Weinstein case is pertinent too, just because of the coercion and the threat of not getting a job, the threat of, you know, holding the career consequences over the head. That's a pretty similar case.
Yeah, so those are the means that are alleged. I'm sorry, Bill, but those are the means that are alleged in this indictment. The means that are alleged for the RICO Act is that the Combs and his organization used all kinds of tools, financial, physical abuse, verbal abuse, threats, coercion, to manipulate these victims. Well, guess what? Except for maybe the physical abuse, and I'm not even sure if that's true, Weinstein did all those same things, right? Held out the promise of jobs to coerce women to do things they didn't want to do, threatened to derail women's careers if they did not perform the sex acts that he wanted them to perform. Those are the exact same allegations here against Sean Combs.
Sean, is it, I mean, as a layman looking at this, or I'm saying if I was on the jury and I'm looking at a RICO case, am I wrong then to look for where the profit motive was? In other words, if he's doing this to just fulfill his personal desires, does that make it a RICO, or does he have to be this criminal? Like, I guess what I'm saying is it doesn't appear that he profited financially from the sex trafficking. It was done more for personal gratification. So does there have to be that profit motive? Is it a criminal enterprise if really all it's doing is covering up its own crimes for personal gratification?
Yeah, I mean, this again goes to the can it be brought, should it be brought? I'm not saying in any way that this does not fit the elements of a RICO case. It does. You read the elements of RICO and you read this indictment, they line up just fine. But should it? They don't have to have explicitly a financial motive. Some of the things that are alleged in this indictment against Combs are that one of the purposes of this RICO organization, which is Combs Enterprises, was to bring him more power so that he could abuse more women and to cover up his crimes when anyone threatened either to go to law enforcement or go public with the crimes that he was committing, right? So, yeah, that's a RICO case, but is it what we typically think of as an organized crime case? Not really, but RICO has been stretched since it was first passed to cover all kinds of things that I think people didn't initially anticipate might be charged as RICO cases, and this is certainly one of them. But, you know, just like Epstein, like you said, at least as I read the indictment here, the motive was Sean Combs' personal sexual gratification, right, and also, frankly, his power over people. That's the same as Epstein. Epstein did not charge a RICO case, right?
But was the is the power part to cover up the crime? You know, like the, a criminal enterprise, the crime must have been in furtherance of the illegal business activity of a criminal group or gang. And that's the part that I struggle with. Like, is that what this is, or is this something else?
You know, the substantive crimes, the substantive federal crimes that are alleged in this indictment, there's two essentially. One is sex trafficking, which is essentially the transportation of commercial sex workers across state lines, which is a federal crime. And the second one is, and it's alleged as to one of the victims in particular, who's only named as victim one. And let me just look at that real quick to make sure I've got it correct here. But it is essentially using force or fraud, right, to transport
or coercion,
a victim,
right,
or coercion right, to have the victim engage in sex trafficking. So those are the two substantive crimes. Are those federal crimes? Yeah. The other stuff is how RICO pulls all that stuff in.
To that point about victim one, as far as I read an indictment, and we'll talk about maybe you know this bail hearing later on, there seems to be only one named victim of kidnapping. Am I wrong on that?
Well, you know, because there's not an actual kidnapping charge. What they've done is they've alleged kidnapping as one of the RICO predicate acts. RICO is a complicated statute. To bring RICO, you have to have a bunch of sort of checked boxes to make up a RICO case. One of them is that the organization has committed certain crimes. And they have, the government has to allege at least two crimes that have furthered the RICO organization for criminal purposes, essentially. And they have to have been occurred generally within 10 years of one another. So that kidnapping is the one of those predicate crimes. But the actual target of this indictment is the sex trafficking.
Right.
The substantive crimes that are alleged are sex trafficking, and the RICO conspiracy is primarily focused on sex trafficking, but using the organization to do it through a number of different means.
Gotcha. And thanks for clarifying that. But do we have more than one victim identified as being sex trafficked?
No. The government doesn't have to identify them, and there's reasons why you wouldn't, especially in the sex case. What little we know is that there was a press conference given by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York shortly after this case was unveiled, in which he alluded to the fact, at least, that there was more than one victim. And in the government's brief that it filed with regards to the bail motions, it alleged a couple of times in that brief that there were dozens of witnesses and victims to the various crimes that they were talking about in the bail motion that are referenced in the indictment. So are there dozens of victims or dozens of witnesses? I'm not sure which it is. They say dozens of witnesses or victims. I don't know exactly how many victims there are. They don't have to allege a certain number, but thus far we know very little about who they are other than obviously Cassie Ventura, because the factual allegations match her allegations in her civil case.
So Sean, do they have to, at trial, if this goes to trial, do they have to prove up the individual predicate offenses? In other words, when they say multiple acts involving kidnapping and they cite the California Penal Code, do they have to actually prove that those kidnappings or that kidnapping took place?
Yes. I mean,
they have to prove at least two predicate crimes to prove up that RICO. So yeah, I expect they're going to put on evidence of those crimes as their predicates, because they do have to prove predicates to the jury to find a RICO violation.
Right.
Yeah.
Sean, let me ask you this. And this is a lot of speculation on anybody's part, but you might know better than anybody here on call. With going for the RICO charge and looking at some of the things in the indictment that it alludes to, how much more investigation? In other words, we know the investigation is still going on.
Yeah.
Do you think that we've got 10% information that's been provided? Are we halfway there? Are we going to have a lot more? And I got a second part to that.
Yeah.
Do you think that part of the reason they've gone RICO here is there's really more than meets the eye so far? In other words, there's a lot of rumor out there, and I know how dangerous rumor is, but there's a lot of rumor out there. There are a number of high profile names involved in this. So again, to go back to the first part of the question, how far along with an indictment of this level do you think that we are along in the investigation?
I think early in that process. It was interesting that early on in Combs' first appearances, there was rumors that he was going to insist on going to trial within the statutory speedy trial limits in federal court, which I understand is 60 days. That would have been very surprising. I think there was a report I read yesterday or the day before that his attorneys requested a date targeting spring or early next year, which is still an aggressive timeline, but that's more doable. I mean, as a defense lawyer, they've known this is coming. They've been able to prepare a lot for this, so that's possible. They could just charge straight into trial and try it. This doesn't seem like a case that's likely to settle. There's too much on the line for Combs. It's not going to settle. And so then the other side on the government is, obviously the government brings these cases at its leisure. Unless there's a statute of limitations, it doesn't have to bring it until it's ready to bring it, right? So you would hope that the government would have already had all of its ducks in a row. I anticipate some of what's going on is the government is still deciding whether or not they're going to file what we call superseding indictments, which is an additional charging document in the same case, naming some of the co-conspirators. I expect what will generally happen in cases, especially involving RICO, is that the federal government is going to be talking to some of those people to determine whether or not they're going to cooperate with the government's case, right? Mm-hmm. That is a classic tactic that is used in organized crime cases. It's interesting, right, that there's a lot of people speculating, well, will Diddy name out all those people who might have been involved with him, which would be weird for the government to go to Diddy for cooperation, Sean Combs, because allegedly he's the chief of the whole organization. So you don't normally cooperate the head of an organization against the little guys, right? You do it the other way around. So I suspect the government is talking to others that are part of this conspiracy that have not yet been named. And they are probably scrambling to come to favorable terms in terms of charges against those additional co-conspirators. Their attorneys are trying very hard to get favorable agreements. And those could involve cooperation against Sean Combs.
And the reality, Sean, is that's one of the thoughts I did have when I looked at this indictment. I said, it's possible that there's already been deals cut. We just don't know. It's possible that there's already been deals cut, that those people have testified before the grand jury. And, you know, that's why the indictment is kind of worded and done the way it is. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah,
or it could be, like you said, we could be looking at a superseding indictment down the road.
Exactly. I can give you a recent example from here in Los Angeles, which is the case involving the death of the actor from Friends,
and Matthew
now
Perry.
I'm blanking on it. Thank
Matthew
you, Matthew Perry.
Perry.
Right. So there's two doctors. There's essentially a drug dealer and his assistant who are charged in that case. And one of the things that happened, I think within 2 weeks of that indictment being unsealed, is one of the doctors, who probably had already negotiated a deal with prosecutors, entered into a plea agreement with the federal government here in Los Angeles, in which he agreed to cooperate.
Yep.
Right. And as a lawyer on the defense side in a case like that, you want to be first in the door for your clients because they're going to get the best benefit because they're going to be of the most use. And so that could be happening behind the scenes. Just as in the Perry case, it was happening behind the scenes. We didn't find out until that change of plea where he goes in and pleads guilty. That could very easily happen here with one or more people who are part of this conspiracy.
Right.
It seems like there'd be a lot. I'm sorry, Bill, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, time will tell. Go ahead, Mark.
Time will tell. But it seems like in this case, if the allegations are halfway accurate here with the indictment, there's a lot of opportunity for deals to be cut. There are a lot of people involved here. We're talking about security guards. We're talking about publicists. We're talking about witnesses, people who took part in the events. So it seems like there's a lot of opportunity. This is not very narrow. Like I said, this is very broad. Focus on one specific behavior, but it's very broad as far as the number of people involved, allegedly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's alleged in the indictment, for instance, that he had a whole cadre of people who whose jobs were to rent the hotels, right, provide the venue, bring things like lubricant and drugs to these freak-offs, the drugs particularly to keep the women compliant with these freak-off parties and having sex, sometimes when otherwise they wouldn't, and clean up afterwards, which was a fascinating part of the indictment, that these same people were also alleged to clean it all up after it was done. And so you're right, Mark, there's a lot of people that were involved in setting up this sex trafficking other than Combs.
And just to talk about the drugs real quick, cocaine, oxycodone, a drug called Nexus, which is like a recreational psychedelic drug, or maybe like a short acting ecstasy, I guess you'd call it, GHB.
Yeah.
A date rape drug, not you know, like not Rohypnol, but a date rape drug that's used for that.
It's used for that. It's I think originally it's an industrial lubricant.
Industrial solvent.
Industrial solvent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And ketamine, a dissociative anesthetic. So this is, you know, these are the type of drugs that were used. One question, and Mark brought it up about potential other people involved. And man, we still hear this with the Epstein case. The quote, the list is about to come out legally. And this is what I tell people. The government's not releasing. They're not in the business of releasing names of people suspected of crimes or people that may or may not be charged with crimes. You're either charged or you're not discussed. I mean, that's how it is. Is that correct, Sean? Like, there should be no anticipation, no matter what you hear about the government releasing lists or anything else, there should be no anticipation that there's going to be any list of names coming out of people, of witnesses or other participants, unless they're charged. It's a liability.
Right. That's 100% correct, Bill. And there's good reasons for that. I mean, the U.S. government does not want to be in the business of defaming people for no reason.
There you go.
Right. They're in the business of charging people with crimes and proving them beyond a reasonable doubt. And as you said, if they can't do that, there's no reason to name those people. And it's the government policy that they will not name those people for that very reason. I mean, you could do all kinds of damage to people's lives in naming them if you're not intending to charge them with a crime. Why would you do that? I'll give you a great example of this. It goes way back, the Heidi Fleiss case, right? Heidi Fleiss was the Hollywood madam, right? Mm-hmm. I know the prosecutor. I worked with him afterwards in one of the large law firms. The prosecutor in that case, Heidi had a book, right? Heidi's little black book had the names of all the people in Hollywood that she hooked up with her prostitutes, right? That book was never released. Why would they? They were in the business of charging sex trafficking and charging Heidi Fleiss in her role in sex trafficking. But if they're not charging them, it's not the government's function to name them just to shame them.
Right. Yeah, and an important point to make. Now, there is an attorney in Texas, I don't know if he's in the Houston area, Sean, who says or claims that he's talked to 120 people who may file. And then he keeps saying, we're going to put out a list, but we want to make sure that our facts are correct before we put it out. You know, even they're kind of giving like the indication that there's a lot of liability here for us to go out and say someone was involved in this. We have to make sure. And, you know, so will other names come out? Who knows? I don't, the government's not going to be behind it.
Yeah, you're right. It's more likely to come out in civil cases. I saw that article. I don't know anything about that attorney. At first blush, without knowing anything else about that case, it sounded like a plaintiff's lawyer trolling for settlements very quickly out of the gate, right?
Right.
I'm not saying that that's what he's doing, but my first blush impression of that was this is a guy who's hoping to get in on the front end and clean up on a lot of settlements or maybe trials. But you're right. That's not what the federal government's going to do in a criminal case. That's not going to happen.
No. Hey, guys, how about the asset forfeiture part of this? The forfeiture allegations, because I haven't heard that really discussed, and that's significant. So what the government has said here, and you know, the government has different venues where they can take your property, or not different venues.
Well, maybe avenues.
Yeah, administrative seizure of your money, civil seizure of your money, or criminal. In this case, it's criminal. And Sean will correct me if I'm off base here. And what the government has said was, if there's any financial gain that was derived from this criminal activity, the government is going to take it. And if there were any instruments used to perpetrate or any assets used to perpetrate these crimes, the government is going to seize those assets. This is done in drug cases all the time. And Mark, I know you know this from the CHP days. I know this from DEA. You're driving a car that has drugs in it. That car was used to facilitate the commission of a drug crime. The car, the government takes the car from you. Or you sell drugs and you profit from that. You collect money. That money is profit from a criminal enterprise. The government's going to take that money from you. Do you know, Sean, is that something that's commonly done in RICO cases?
It is.
You know, there's a fascinating case that was done here in Los Angeles against the Mongols motorcycle gang. Mm-hmm. And one of the unique things, the government not only went after the Mongols and they convicted a number of them in a RICO conspiracy case, they went after their assets, but they also went after their intellectual property, the actual Mongols logo, right?
I remember
the government
that.
After it as an asset seizure, which was absolutely fascinating. So this is typical. One of the reasons, again, that RICO is so powerful is it gives these tools. So not only are you taking apart the organization by imprisoning the individuals involved, but you also take away their assets, which also cripples those organizations. And that is fairly typical in a RICO case. And as you said, it's fairly typical the government would initiate forfeiture against proceeds and instruments that were used in the commission of those crimes.
A couple of things that I think are interesting, because I'm trying to look for the exact date here. I think, so since April of 24, P. Diddy put his jet, which is a Gulfstream G550, okay? Mm-hmm. I think it's a 2015 model worth somewhere between $28 million and $35 million. Expensive airplane. Last April, he put it up for sale. Now, in March, he and his lawyers learned of the investigation of him and the nature of the investigation. I mean, we don't know the specifics. We don't know if it was, whether he knew it was RICO or what the potential charges were going to be or what. But do I think there's a connection? Now, if that jet was used to traffic people for the purpose of sex, right, that this whole freak off thing or whatever it's called, if that jet was used to move people around the country for that purpose, the government could seize that jet from Sean Combs. Is that's correct, Sean?
I believe that's correct. Absolutely. Right.
I would too. So, I mean, the fact that he puts the jet up for sale a month after he learns of the investigation, interesting. Also, though, I mean, he's been hit with a bunch of civil cases, so he could just trying to be liquidating assets. The other point is his home, which I don't know, the home in Los Angeles.
I think it was the one in Miami, Bill, they were talking about. Selling?
Great point, yeah. Mark. Two things. The home in Los Angeles, he put on the market now.
Right.
For $61 million. And again, if there was evidence that one of these events, let's call it an event, one of these events happened at this home, the argument could be made that the government could seize that home, that could seize that property from Combs, a $61 million property. Significant asset. Now that house is now for sale. Again, is that why he's selling it? I don't know. He could just be tired of LA, right? But interesting that these large assets connected to the criminal case are all of a sudden up for sale, you know, right about the time when he learns of the case. Now there is a substitute asset clause or what how would you guys term that?
Well, and I know you're aware of this, Sean, but if you guys would actually humor me a little bit and let me read this, because when I read this in the indictment, this was actually news to me. I didn't know, you know, being around asset forfeiture, but I didn't know. So for you know, just my edification here and for the audience. So substitute assets provision. If any of the above described forfeitable property as a result of any act or omission of the defendant cannot be located, I'm going to summarize here. Has been transferred or sold, has been placed beyond the jurisdiction of the court, has been substantially diminished in value, has been co-mingled with other property, on. It is the intent of the United States, I'm skipping some stuff here, to seek forfeiture of any property of the defendant up to the value of the above forfeitable property. In other words, if we can't find the property used in the commission of these crimes, we're going to seize other property to offset what we can't find. Is that
And Mark, let me jump in here, because you just connected us back to the very first thing we talked about today, which was, why make this a RICO case? Mm-hmm. Sean, if this was strictly sex trafficking, is there an asset seizure part of it?
There may be. Although I got to say, I'm not as familiar with federal asset forfeiture because it's not my area of practice. RICO gives you powerful tools to seize broadly because it's the organization that is the one of the targets of that criminal charge. Whereas individual sex trafficking, I don't know necessarily that it would give you the same reach.
So that's a potential reason to use this charge with someone who has, you know, this tremendous amount of wealth, is to go after the assets.
Yeah. The other interesting thing, you know, is that comes paid off as Florida Home, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, right?
$18 million.
He had an $18 million balance on the mortgage. He paid off that $18 million. And I was just mentioning earlier to Sean something which I call the OJ law. Has nothing really to do with OJ other than OJ lost the civil suit to Nicole Brown's family and dumped all his money into a Florida house because of something called the homestead or the home. There's a homestead law in Florida, makes no value limit. So there's no value limit to it. Your house cannot be taken in a civil judgment. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And I think, you know, it's appropriate in some ways to call it that because the state law generally does not prevent the federal government from doing very much, mm-hmm. right? So a federal forfeiture action in a criminal case will not be staved off by the Florida Homestead Act. The federal government believes that his house in Florida is seizable as proceeds of a crime. They can seize it, and the Homestead Act won't protect them. But it will do is it will protect the value of that house and the house itself from creditors who are going to bring what presumably will be hundreds of lawsuits against Sean Combs. And by paying off that $18 million balance, that is $18 million that is now protected from being seized by the civil plaintiffs who are going to come after Combs.
Great. Yeah. It's basically a place to shelter your money and keep it from civil judgments.
Yeah, that's correct.
You're right. What about the bail issues here, Sean? Mark, anything to talk about there?
I'm gonna let Sean really dive into this. He has the experience. I have to admit, I have a lot of mixed feelings about this. Looking back historically, when you compare this to other cases, when you compare it to really some mafia, heads of mafia, factor in O.J. Simpson, who spent the entire year he was on trial in county jail, and these are different cases. Some mafia heads have been out on bail. O.J. Simpson accused of killing two people. He's, you know, bail is not allowed. So there's on my part, reading this bail motion, I'm sure, Sean, you'll do a great job getting into this. I have mixed feelings about it, and I'll get back to, you know, where I stand on it. I will say this, just real quick. Like you guys have said, his lawyers saw this coming, and I think they've done a lot in the, you know, at least probably a year, but let's say this is the last 6-7 months, a lot to do everything they can proactively to be in the best position in front of a magistrate to be awarded, you know, bail here. That's clear to me. That's my opinion. But having said that, Sean, I'm going to turn it over to you and have you dive into this.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because I talked to some of my federal prosecutor friends here in Los Angeles when the initial bail hearing was conducted in front of the magistrate and bail was, or not bail, because actually the federal system doesn't have bail per se like California does, but it's called a detention hearing. It's to determine whether he's going to remain in custody or whether the judge will release him either on his own recognizance or with certain conditions, right? And there, some of my friends actually at first blush were surprised that he was detained. And I'll tell you, some of the reasons are like, it's Sean Diddy Combs. Like, where is he going to go that he's not going to be recognized, right? Like, and he has done, as you said, Mark, in the last year, a lot of things. Like, he flew back, according to his lawyers, from out of the country to be present so that they could arrest him. He has offered to surrender passports, not only his, but his family's passports. he's done a lot of things to set himself up. And is this guy really a flight risk? I mean, I'm sure there's some danger, but that he might flee to somewhere we don't have an extradition treaty with. But really, I have a hard time imagining Sean Combs fleeing to China or Cuba or other places where we don't have an extradition treaty and them not kicking him out. And so there's a strong initial reaction, which is this guy's not a flight risk. I think one of the things that really turned this case for Combs in terms of the bail motion was all the allegations in the indictment that him and others in Combs Enterprises used violence, force, threats of violence, and obstruction of justice, all kinds of things to intimidate witnesses and to get witnesses to change their story. There's actually an allegation, I believe it's in the government's bail motion, that says that on two occasions, Combs actually recorded conversations he had with witnesses where he was telling them what story they were going to tell, and he was going to pay them to tell that story. That's the real big concern here, is that Combs is going to continue to intimidate witnesses from coming forth. He's going to continue to manipulate witnesses and their testimony and to obstruct justice. And I think ultimately that's what convinced both the magistrate judge and then on review, the federal district court judge, who they had a bail hearing with shortly afterwards, who also denied, not bail, that's a state term I'm just used to, but they denied him release. Now it's going to be up in the Court of Appeal. I would be very surprised if Combs got any action on the Court of Appeal after those two judges had had a hearing and found that there were some dangers there that couldn't be mitigated without Combs being detained in jail. The other part of this is, in the federal system, you have certain crimes that are presumed to be detention. And so it turns out that this is one of those crimes. This is a what they call a presumption case in federal court, which means that there is already the burden is against the defendant in some ways to prove that he is suitable for release. And so that is an initial burden that he has to overcome. And in this case, I think the allegations in the indictment about obstruction and witness tampering were enough that the judges said, yeah, we're not going to risk that.
Yeah, I think that the fact that the count two, the sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion, that's a presumptive case. And you hit the nail on the head. He has to work back from that point. In other words, okay, the presumption is that you're going to be detained. What information do you have to provide the government that shows that this assessment is incorrect? And it's hard from his position with the allegations here to overcome that. He's just not going to overcome that. Would you know? Is there enough to ensure he's going to appear? Probably, but the danger to the community part, that's what he's not going to overcome. And I think he will be detained until this thing finally goes to trial.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I think that, you know, the most compelling reason for denying the detention or release, whatever, like you said, at this federal level, is really the witness tampering allegation. And by the way, and clearly, like you said, he has a history of it. Am I really concerned that he's a threat to the general population, especially now, having been indicted, so he knows that the focus is on him? I'll be honest with you. I'm not really concerned about the general public safety. I am concerned about the integrity of the prosecution of the case, because if his likelihood to tamper with witnesses and to intimidate people, either directly or through a so-called chain of command, that's much more difficult to do from federal prison or federal lockup.
That's right, Mark. So, for instance, the judge could have released him on home arrest. He's not going to be organizing more freak-offs while he's on home arrest. That's not going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. It's the obstruction piece that is really the danger, I think, that the court was concerned with. And it's interesting, you know, my first reaction when I heard of the detention decision and some of the surprise of some of my friends was, all right, is there a racial bias at play here, right? I mean, or is it Sean's history as a gangster rapper? Because certainly he's got a history going back of other stuff that is criminal. And is that a piece of it? And I'll tell you, the first analog I could think of that was a similar case was the Epstein case.
Yeah.
And so I immediately went, all right, I'm curious. Like, let's look up Epstein. What happened to him? Was he released or was he detained? Well, he was detained. And so I think it's right that it's the nature of the charge, which is the sex trafficking. As you said, bail by force or fraud is a presumptive case. And then secondly, the dangers that are present in this case because of his past behavior.
Do either of you know if Harvey Weinstein got bail on the state case?
No, he did not.
He did not either, right? Right.
Yeah, I don't think he did. Now, my recollection is, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but my recollection was that he did not.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
What else? Any other loose ends on this one? I mean, my bet is we see a jury trial. What about you two?
Sean, go ahead.
100%. This case is not going to settle. This is going to go to trial. It's going to be a big splash. It's just the kind of case the Southern District of New York loves to bring. It's a high impact. It dovetails into the cultural zeitgeist of, you know, shutting down these kinds of abusers who use their resources and riches to abuse hundreds of women. It's a celebrity case. It involves somebody who's wealthy. It's exactly the kind of case Southern District of New York loves to make a big splash with. I expect it fully to go to trial.
Agreed.
That's it, Mark.
I mean, it's just, there's no way. Yeah. What's he going to do? I mean, what are the options here? He's going to go ahead and plead to 14 years. I doubt it, because he's looking at the rest of his life in prison on these RICO charges. And so, and the other thing is too, he does have the means to obviously have the highest paid defense team that you could possibly imagine. And so what are the odds? And then of course you can appeal and things like this, but I'm with you. I don't really see an easy way out for him. It's not like you're going to get probation here, certainly at the federal level. So I agree with you, Sean.
This is a 15-year minimum case, Sean?
Yeah, the sex trafficking by force or fraud is a minimum 15, max life. Right. You know, the maximums are not as important in federal cases as a gauge of what a sentence might be, but the minimums are. And that mandatory minimum of 15 years means Combs is going to be something like 70 when he finally serves that minimum 15 years. Because you got to remember, in the federal system, for the most part, you're serving 85% of your sentence.
Yeah. Yeah,
you get very little credit for a good time.
Right, and they give you a point score, and his point score is just based on some of the allegations, which would actually they would need to prove at trial. If they prove those allegations at trial, that's going to bump up his score.
Yeah.
So one more thing, what to look for going forward? I think a good point you brought up was the potential of a superseding indictment. You and Mark both talked about that. Maybe there's more victims that come forward, and this was just kind of a placeholder to get things rolling, and then the government includes more charges. Anything else to look for going forward?
Yeah, I think the biggest
thing that will happen will be superseding indictments, and we're going to see more conspirators brought in. Okay. In what capacity will be the really interesting thing to see, whether they're cooperators or they're people the government is just ticking off as additional defendants who may not be as involved as Combs, but were still involved enough that they should be charged federally. I think there's going to be cooperators, is my guess. That's fairly typical. And like you said, Bill, the one thing that happens is once the government files that indictment, it's like a dam being broken, right? And the civil lawsuits are already coming because there's, you know, millions and millions of dollars potentially that could be recovered from plaintiffs. But it's also, even without that piece, I've seen it in state courts, once you file those charges, additional victims come forward. They were too afraid to come forward before, but now that he's detained, right, and they're not alone, they will come forward. That typically happens. And so I would expect more victims to come forward, and I expect to see the government charge more defendants.
Hey, and one quick thing along those lines. If there was a lawsuit that Combs settled and paid off a victim, and there was an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, they are in a criminal case, that person is absolved from that NDA. They're basically compelled by the government.
Yeah. Now, my understanding is with an NDA that the NDA cannot, as a matter of public policy, preclude them from testifying in court in a criminal case. Right. And so the NDA is completely ineffective as to that. And that is, and frankly, most NDAs would include language that says that. But even if it does not, it doesn't matter. It's an illegal agreement if it says you will not testify in criminal court against me if charges are brought, because that's obstruction. You can't condone a contract that endorses obstruction of justice.
That's a great point. Hey, well, a fascinating case, folks. Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead. No, I was just kidding. On the NDA, in other words, but just to clarify, Sean, you can't compel someone to testify. The point is, I mean, I'm asking a question. It just protects them civilly if they choose to in this case. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah,
they can't be sued for a violation of the non-disclosure agreement, because that's an exception that's universally recognized in the United States is, testifying against them in a criminal proceeding.
And technically, if they were subpoenaed for that criminal proceeding, they would be in contempt and potentially, you know, have their own adverse criminal consequences to it. Right.
That is exactly correct.
A fascinating case, a one-person RICO, probably additional charges in the future. We'll see a huge asset forfeiture component, which could end up being $100 million plus. Thank you, Sean, for that incredible breakdown. Thank you, Chief, for what you always do here. And folks, stay tuned. If there's updates on this, we'll get back and we'll bring them to you. Thanks for joining us today.